live from our nation's capital.
All talk here in Washington, D.C. turns to President-elect Joe Biden's administration.
Historically speaking, the markets have performed better when there is divided government.
The biggest pressure for fiscal stimulus is an uptick in cases.
Bloomberg Sound On. The insiders, the influencers, the insights.
Biden has promised again and again that he will unite the country. State governments control elections. That's in the Constitution.
I think that we can expect a smooth, thoughtful, methodical transition.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
President-elect Joe Biden talks about Thanksgiving. Should your family gather? Plus, New York City schools close as the virus rate reaches 3% trigger point in the Big Apple. All of this as talks continue, not just between Republicans and Democrats about a potential fiscal stimulus deal, but also between Speaker Pelosi and Biden. A lot to get through. We begin tonight with Sound On from President-elect Joe Biden speaking at a virtual roundtable healthcare summit from Biden headquarters in Wilmington. He says that Thanksgiving is going to be a little different for his family this year. Take a listen.
Thanksgiving's coming up. Well, they said, Joe, maximum 10 people in your home. Maximum, Joe. I got a big family you probably heard a lot about. We do everything together. Well, you know, we're just not going to there going to be three of us.
It comes from a broader perspective as U.S. stocks slumped, with fresh restrictions curtailing the spread of coronavirus, overshadowing signs that scientists are making fast progress toward a vaccine. And New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, speaking from City Hall, saying that the nation's largest school system will go completely remote as the coronavirus takes on hold of New York City. Here's some sound on that from de Blasio.
We had bad news. We spent some time confirming it and double-checking it because it is exactly on the number of 3.00%. We do need to close our schools for the coming days. No one is happy about this decision. We all, in fact, are feeling very sad about this decision.
And as the virus continues to wreak havoc across Republican and Democratic-controlled states, President-elect Biden is moving closer to formally claiming the White House as states push ahead with certifying election results, despite President Donald Trump's efforts to challenge the vote. Earlier today, the pressure mounting not just from reporters and Democrats, but also from Republicans. Take a listen to Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, who spoke earlier to reporters and said that President Trump has to get the Biden transition team up to speed.
And I would urge him to give intel briefings to Joe Biden. How much further to go, I don't know. We're going to be fine. At the end of the day, this thing will work itself out.
Wendy Benjaminson is politics editor for us here at Bloomberg News. And Wendy, it's now Republicans who are urging President Trump to meet with the transition team of President-elect Joe Biden, particularly on matters of national security, as well as the coronavirus.
Yes, well, some Republicans are. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Some Republicans are, and they seem to be limiting it to the national security briefings, the intelligence briefings, which he is, of course, entitled to as president-elect. But the president-elect is complaining today, and his staff was yesterday, about the fact that they can't get any visibility into any federal agency right now until the GSA, the General Services Administration, ascertains that he is the winner. And so that means they cannot begin to coordinate with the FDA on vaccine distribution or the CDC on, you know, new guidance during the uptick of cases. There are a million areas in which the troop withdrawal is another thing. You know, Joe Biden technically is a private citizen, and so he has no ability to talk to these officials about any of these really important issues that are all going to get dumped on his lap on January 20th.
So let me follow up on this, because yesterday our colleague David Westin on Bloomberg Television and Radio's Balance of Power interviewed HHS Secretary Alex Azar, and he asked him point blank about whether or not it was problematic that the Trump administration is not providing coronavirus briefings to Biden's transition team. And Secretary Azar, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially said, Wendy, well, the bureaucrats are going to handle that. What is the Biden transition team saying about what they're missing out on? And other than this is an American virus and not a partisan virus, but what are they missing out on? And what impact is that having in terms of their ability to get in there on January 21st and hit the ground running?
Well, I have to go off what they say, which is the opposite of what Secretary Azar says. And what they say is that they would like to know, for example, what is the Trump administration's vaccine distribution plan? Because if they agree with it and it's all swimming along, then as soon as Pfizer or BioNTech or Moderna get the approval to start mass producing their vaccine, great. President Biden, after January, will be able to distribute the vaccine. But what if Biden's people don't like the Trump vaccine distribution plan? They need to make plans now to change it so we're not all sitting in our homes next summer. That's the sort of thing. Do you have enough refrigeration trucks to keep the vaccine cold? What is your plan for distributing it? What order are you going to distribute it in? They can't get those answers any more than anyone else can.
Do you think, Wendy Benjaminson, Bloomberg politics editor with us, do you think, Wendy, that people like Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican of South Carolina, who we just heard from, do you think that that is going to provide enough pressure on the Trump administration to begin some of those briefings?
I don't know. I don't know. I think that would require me getting inside President Donald Trump's head. I think he is not going to give up this fight easily. I think we can see that. There is mounting pressure from a lot of Republicans that the vote fraud lawsuit pursuit is becoming quixotic at best, that they have not, produced any evidence of massive fraud, that there is that there aren't enough votes to change the election outcome. And if Joe Biden really does have 306 electoral votes, that's a lot of wiggle room to even lose a state. So I think there is pressure. I'm not sure exactly when President Trump is going to accept that he's lost and hand over the government to President-elect Biden.
This meshes with my reporting. Earlier today, I spoke with a source, Wendy, who essentially said, especially Maggie's story in the Times from the last, I think it's 24 hours now, with regards to the legal fees surrounding Rudy Giuliani, of course, the president's personal attorney, who's been leading this effort. And the team around him is really perplexed in terms of what the longer term strategy is, not just for President Trump, but for someone like Giuliani. And so it I hear what you're saying, and it really is, I think, interesting, because right now a lot of these sources that we all talk to are trying to figure out where should they be directing their long-term chess match, so to speak, because the election's over. Mm-hmm. So what's their longer-term strategy? And we're watching them all grapple with this and figure this out in real time. You mentioned the vaccines. Let's just provide a quick Bloomberg News coronavirus update. Pfizer saying that a final analysis, Wendy just pointed to this, Pfizer saying a final analysis of clinical trial data showed that its vaccine was 95% effective, paving the way for the company to apply for the first U.S. regulatory authorization for a coronavirus shot within days. The U.S. gave the green light for the first COVID-19 diagnostic kit for self-testing at home, adding a tool to battle the pandemic as nationwide testing capabilities come under more strain and more U.S. states imposing restrictions, as we've alluded to tamp down the unrelenting surge. It's remarkable because a lot of the issues, and this will be, we only have a minute left, but I'll end with this. In Europe, in Germany specifically, there's been a protest over Germany's strategy to quell the virus, and it actually turned violent. Poland reported a record 603 deaths, and UK doctors warned that tough new measures must be placed when England's lockdown ends. It's really remarkable. This is not a uniquely American problem. Tokyo, for example, also reporting a record number of new cases Wednesday. Remarkable. Wendy Benjaminson, I want to thank you so much for your time, my friend. It's always great to hear with you. Have you watched the new episodes of the new season of The Crown?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I'm up to episode 4, I think.
Oh, it gets good.
3 or 4, I can't remember which.
It gets so good. No, I won't tell you anything, but let me tell you, you're in for a treat, my friend. Always great to catch up with you. Make sure you watch that. I'm Kevin Cirilli, always having fun. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. It's fun to smile, right? You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
I'm Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. I was talking to my mom earlier. I said, Mom, you know, we're not doing the Thanksgiving thing this year because, you know, the virus. But I said, I got to get a pie recipe. You know, I got to make a pie. I love apple pie. When I was a kid, I made it back in Delco with our next door neighbors, the Rileys. And we made the best apple pie. It was so good. I love pie. I really do. It's the quintessential, for me, it's the quintessential Thanksgiving dish. Pies. I don't know. Pecan. What else? Pumpkin. And of course, my dad always loves pecan. But apple with a little bit of vanilla ice cream. Anyway, so if you got some good pie recipes, send them my way. I love a good pie. Okay, time for the market update. And we begin, of course, with U.S. stocks slumping as fresh restrictions to curtail the spread of coronavirus overshadowed signs that scientists are making fast progress toward a vaccine. The dollar, folks, held near its lowest level in 2 years. The S&P 500 index closed at its lows of the day after New York City shut schools because of rising infection. Pfizer advanced after saying that its COVID-19 vaccine was 95% effective, paving the way for the company to apply for the first U.S. regulatory authorization for a coronavirus shot within days. Love that news. Lowe's slumped after earnings trailed analysts' expectations, while Target advanced on soaring sales. You know, it all comes with so much mixed information, whether it's traders looking at what's happening with New York City schools or the optimism around the vaccines. And my colleagues on Bloomberg Television and Bloomberg Radio got us some sound from Michael Kushma, the CIO of Global Fixed Income at Morgan Stanley. And he told Bloomberg earlier today, with an uncertain economic outlook, the toughest thing to do is get money in the pockets of consumers. Here's some sound on that.
That is the challenge, is getting people remaining confident, keeping the economy running at a reasonable pace, keeping money in people's pockets so that even if they're not spending it today, when the gates are lifted, when the lockdowns are lifted, there is money in people's pockets, whether it's the corporate sector, the household sector, they can go out and spend. And that was what's going to have a very strong pop down the road and compensates, in theory, at least for the weakness we're seeing now.
Calvin Schnorr is a senior economist at NAREIT, and he is a frequent guest on this program. We're always grateful for his time. Calvin, I mean, we just heard some sound on getting money back in the pockets of consumers, and we're seeing the uncertainty in the markets over the past couple of days. So is Mr. Kushma right?
Well, first of all, Kevin, you and I have been talking about the impact of the coronavirus on the economy for 8 months now.
Yeah.
And one thing that I've stressed again and again is that the economy is not going to be healthy until until the public is healthy, until the health crisis is more under control. So it's not surprising to see the market rising and falling on news like this. And we've seen a big surge lately in the new cases. But in terms of getting money in the hands of consumers, I would take a very different view. You know, we've seen that the labor market is has been struggling. We saw huge job losses. It's come back a bit. You still have 7% unemployment, 6.9%. But that means 93% of the people are employed. And actually, people have had money building up in their bank accounts. You look at the Federal Reserve statistics, there's an increase of about $3 trillion since the beginning of the year. So people do have money to spend. And we're seeing that in the retail sales numbers that come out. Retail sales are pretty robust despite the worries about the virus.
You know, I got to focus on what really has been one of the hot pockets of the U.S. economy. And it's something that I really don't think the nerd in me has been able to focus in enough on. Calvin Schnoor, senior economist over there at NAREIT. And that's the housing market. I mean, the housing market is the hottest part of the U.S. economy. Why?
That's right. The housing market actually is hot enough that it would look good even in a normal economic environment. The economy is struggling. Why is it going so well? And I do appreciate that you turn to the nerd here for the answer.
I'm glad someone does, Calvin, you know, because I have fun when I get to nerd out. But go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
What we've seen is, you know, pretty much every aspect of the housing market is strong. We've seen strong home sales for several months and rising housing prices. And this morning we got data from the Census Department that housing starts came out, and they rose 4.9%. Now, the Bloomberg consensus expectation was 3.2%, so it was a strong number. And September starts were revised up to 6% growth. So this is a really strong number. A lot of things going on. Part of it is pandemic. People want to get out of a downtown apartment into a home. That said, you know, maybe it's safer to be out in the suburbs. Interest rates are really low. I was talking earlier that a lot of households actually are doing pretty well. So there's a lot of financial backing that is driving home sales and housing prices right now.
So I hear you, and let me follow up on this, because this has been a thread over the past several months. I hear you that the housing market for a certain class of Americans has been doing very well. But it is well documented, whether it's on the Bloomberg Terminal with data or what the folks over at McKinsey are doing, for example, that lower socioeconomic income Americans are really struggling right now. And so, and it's you know, whether it's rural America or in cities, and there's this palpable sense of anxiety, economic anxiety, that even the layoffs that have come cross sector, across the country, might start hitting white-collar jobs. And so what can policymakers do to provide some certainty? And, you know, we're a couple of months away from vaccines being widespread, but what can policymakers in D.C. do now to alleviate some of that potential risk? Do you know what I mean?
Well, we've been having back-and-forth discussion about another round of fiscal stimulus, and it's just completely caught up in the politics. We've seen that. Fiscal stimulus that would help, you know, the households that are struggling. This crisis has really worsened income inequality and wealth inequality. The people who can work from home in the suburbs and have a 401k are doing well. The people who are on the front lines in retail or other, they're struggling, particularly if they're renting. Another stimulus package that would help the businesses, help the unemployment insurance, would really be an extra insurance valve right now, insurance cover.
And so to follow up on that, and Calvin Schnoor is with us. He's a senior economist over at NAREIT, and we're talking about some of the harder parts of the recovery and also some of the bright spots. There are other people, and you know this, Calvin, who are looking, trying to see, okay, once we do get out of this, is there going to be some type of collapse in the tech market? But I want to stay with housing, because we saw what happened, you know, a couple of decades ago when there was a housing bubble and the market boom was in the mid-2000s and it didn't end too well. And so are you concerned that some of the hot spots or the bright spots for certain sectors of the economy are actually going to end up being bubbles that burst?
No, this is completely different, and I could have just answered said no. There's no similarity. there's some things that make you think, well, a lot of construction, rising prices. You know, the 2000s had some trouble, but then what we had was a speculative building boom. There was so much construction, and there was a lot of lending through the subprime mortgage market that meant people who previously couldn't buy a home, would buy a home. We have a housing shortage now, and keeping in mind, we were talking a minute ago about the lower-income people who are struggling with paying rents and everything. The housing shortage has really pushed up rents for people in apartments.
Wow.
And kept people from being able to buy a home. So this increase in housing starts today is like 1.5 million total, 1.2 million annual rate for single-family starts.
Yep.
That's actually below the trend pace you need for population growth. We have not made up the lack of housing that was built over the prior decade. So this is good news.
Fascinating. Your favorite Thanksgiving pie, quickly.
I make my grandmother's pie crust recipe for apple pie.
Oh, I love that. Love those family recipes. It's like I should do like a Delco cookbook. All right. Thank you so much, Calvin Schnoor, senior economist at Nareit. Much more coming up next. I'm Kevin Cirilli. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
Live from our nation's capital.
All talk here in Washington, D.C. turns to President-elect Joe Biden's administration.
Historically speaking, the markets have performed better when there is divided government.
The biggest pressure for fiscal stimulus is an uptick in cases.
Bloomberg, sound off. The insiders, the influencers, the insights.
Biden has promised again and again that he will unite the country. State governments control elections. That's in the Constitution.
I think that we can expect a smooth, thoughtful, methodical transition.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
The virus continues to surge and families across the country readjusting their Thanksgiving plans. This as New York City schools to close as the virus rate reaches the 3% trigger point. Investors react, and Pfizer says that their vaccine is now 95% effective. And Republicans now urging President Trump to start cooperating with President-elect Joe Biden. We have a jam-packed show and a lot to get through. So buckle up, and we begin tonight with Sound On Thanksgiving. This coming from President-elect Joe Biden, who spoke at a virtual roundtable at a healthcare summit from Biden HQ in Wilmington, Delaware. And he said that his family, along with other millions of Americans of families, is going to be a little bit different for them this year. Here he is.
Thanksgiving's coming up. Well, they said, Joe, maximum 10 people in your home, maximum, Joe. I got a big family you probably heard a lot about. We do everything together. Well, you know, we're just not going to, there are going to be three of us.
Meanwhile, states both controlled by Republicans and Democrats having to take differing actions as coronaviruses continue to spike across the country. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio spoke from City Hall earlier today and said that the nation's largest school system will go completely remote as the coronavirus continues to take hold of the Big Apple. Here he is.
We had bad news. We spent some time confirming it and double-checking it because it is exactly on the number of 3.00%. We do need to close our schools for the coming days. No one is happy about this decision. We all, in fact, are feeling very sad about this decision.
And even as optimism was greeted, not just on the markets, but by others, as Pfizer said that a final analysis of their clinical trial data showed that their vaccine is 95% effective and thus has paved the way for the company to apply for the first U.S. regulatory authorization for a coronavirus shot within days. Republicans are now urging President Trump to cooperate with the transition team of President-elect Joe Biden. And we've got Sound On that transition coming from Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, who spoke with reporters earlier today and talked about President Trump and the Biden transition team. Here he is.
And I would urge him to give intel briefings to Joe Biden. How much further to go, I don't know. We're going to be fine. At the end of the day, this thing will work itself out.
Aaron McPike is a liberal political and media strategist, and Scott Tranter is a CEO of Optimus and the former data science director for Marco Rubio for President's campaign. We're thrilled to welcome them back both to the program. And Scott, let me follow up with you from what we just heard from Senator Lindsey Graham, who is now urging President Trump to cooperate with the Biden transition team. Do you agree?
Yes. I mean, look, everyone's got a point. We still have to do the electoral votes. I'm sorry, the Electoral College has to vote in a couple of weeks. But it looks by and large, despite all the lawsuits that are out there, that this is heading to an inauguration for President-elect Joe Biden. So I think it's time for a transition. Doesn't mean they can't roll any of these things back, but we should prepare for all eventualities. And it's something that should happen.
Let me follow up on this point, because I want to be precise with the question and to follow up here. Even if there were to be some other outside event that would alter President-elect Joe Biden's plans for January 20th, should the coronavirus at least be a nonpartisan issue, a scientific issue, in terms of trying to make sure that once this vaccine is ready, that all players, all politicians of all political stripes know how to lead.
Yeah, decisively, yes. And even more importantly, there is nothing lost or gained. I'm sorry, there's nothing lost by reading in and coordinating with the Biden transition team. It doesn't take away from anything what the current Trump administration is doing, and it doesn't take anything away from any of the current lawsuits or any electoral things that need to be sorted out. You know, coordination is just good public policy going forward. It can only be additive for the country.
Headlines crossing the Bloomberg terminal just within the last half hour that shows Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi saying she has spoken just within the last day with President-elect Joe Biden. This upon fresh reports, Aaron McPike, liberal political and media strategist, that the Biden transition team is talking with lawmakers about what a next round of stimulus would look like. The Business Roundtable also coming out with their list of priorities for what that stimulus could potentially look like. What are you hearing, Aaron, from your colleagues in the House as well as the Senate on the Democratic side of the aisle about the timetable for such stimulus, if it doesn't especially get accomplished in the lame duck?
Yeah, well, you know, I keep hearing that it's not going to happen until early next year, which is unfortunate because the faster that it can move before the end of the year, the better for the economy, of course. So many things are slowed down, and that looks to be the case through the end of November and into December, that they might not be able to do anything until Biden becomes president. I mean, at least they could shepherd it through early next year, but the makeup of the Senate will not change much, and there will be more Republicans in the House. So, you know, unfortunately, I think it is taking too long. But if they can pass something and move something through in January, I think that's the best case at this point.
Red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal just as Aaron was speaking. The Senate has prepared to leave for recess without voting on Judy Shelton as a nomination for the, of course, Federal Reserve Board. This, of course, coming following a Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, announcing that he was diagnosed with COVID-19 yesterday. And support amongst Republicans simply just not being there, the math not there for President Trump's pick to be on the Federal Reserve Board. So again, the Senate preparing to leave for recess without voting on Fed Reserve Board nominee Judy Shelton. So a new headline crossing on that as well. In terms of what the President Trump can do, Scott, in the remaining weeks that he has left in terms of in office. We've heard this week and we've talked about it, but sticking with the theme of coronavirus, what can he do on his way out with the coronavirus?
Well, and I may be a minor voice on this, at least on my side of the party, certainly on the transition side, making sure whatever eventualities happen come January, either team is ready to step in and make sure the coronavirus activities, the virus, the warp speed, all those things go forward. The other thing you can do is certainly, look, we have a continuing resolution vote coming up in mid-December to fund the government. I know we just talked about the stimulus, but it, you know, there's some talk there that while it's not a stimulus, we could see some stimulus-like packages and programs stuck into the continuing resolution. That there's an opportunity there to fill in. You know, there's some grumbling from the states that, you know, it's great we got a virus, but we don't have enough money for refrigeration. Or it's great we have a vaccine for the virus, but we don't have, you know, money for refrigeration trucks and things like that. I think there's an opportunity there for the Trump administration. This might be their last legislative accomplishment.
The good old political Christmas tree vehicle, right? They got to dress it up. I was at the Willard Hotel, and they've got their holiday decor up earlier today, and I thought it's beginning to feel like the holidays. Love the Willard Hotel. I'm Kevin Cirilli. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. So I'm at the Willard earlier today with a talking, you know, doing my job. And they put up all of the holiday displays, and they've got them down in City Center as well. You know, in that one alleyway in City Center where they change the, I don't know if it's like the roof adjacent between the walks. And, you know, it's beginning to feel like the holidays. And I got to say, my favorite time of year in D.C., literally, is always the holidays. I think it's such a beautiful, magical city, and the history of it. It's I gotta stay focused on that. You know, I gotta stay focused on that, even in these tough times. And I get it. Trust me, I get it. But it's a magical city. It's a historic city. And it look they do. Remember in the Capitol, you ever been in the halls of Congress and it smells like smoke and you're like, what's going on? And they light the chimneys, you know, in the halls of Congress, and it smells literally like chestnuts roasting on an open fire. It's awesome. It's awesome. I remember, and then I'll get back on topic. Barada's off this week, Christine. So and allow me to keep going with the tangent. When President Trump did the holiday media White House press gathering, as was the tradition, I took my mom, and they had the best holiday cookies. I mean, the best. And she stuffed them in her pocketbook to take home for my godson, Petey. And I will never, ever forget it. And it was such a great memory. Probably my favorite memory of the last 5 years. Aaron McPike's with us, our Democrat for the hour. And, of course, Scott Tranter, our Republican for the hour. I talked about the halls of Congress and the chestnuts. Well, Speaker Pelosi is back in charge. That's a sort of a transition, kind of rough. But they elected her. The Democratic caucus re-elected her for being Speaker of the House again. And take a listen, because we've got sound on how she's going to navigate her caucus. Take a listen to Speaker Pelosi today talking about how she's going to perform as Speaker of the House. Here she is.
I'm very honored. I was kind of emotional earlier because of some of the things that were said in nomination. I'm thrilled. I'm excited. And I can't wait to be elected, working with a new president of the United States, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
Aaron McPike, she not only has to work with President-elect Joe Biden, but she also has to work with the progressives who are wondering how exactly she will navigate the ideological spectrum in her caucus. How will she, Aaron?
Well, I think she's been doing it for a long time, and especially in the Trump era, she's proved rather deft at it. You know, I think she and Mitch McConnell will have to work more closely together, but the thing is, with a Biden presidency, there will be a lot more predictability about the way things will go than there ever has been with a Trump presidency. So, you know, I think the agenda clearly will be maybe less big and bold and ambitious than it would have been had Democrats won the Senate and expanded their margins as expected in the House versus losing some seats. But I think the progressives will have to fall in line here because they're not going to get a very progressive agenda through. And look, Joe Biden will have a pretty significant agenda in terms of helping the country deal with this public health crisis, get vaccines distributed, and rebuilding the pandemic office and working with Congress so that we can avoid situations like this again in the future. And then there's a big economic recovery that's going to happen, and they will do a lot with small business and I believe also with infrastructure. And I think that will be the order of the day for the next year.
So let me follow up on that.
I don't think the progressive members of the caucus will have an issue with that. They won't get a lot of the big, bold ticket items that they want, but I don't think they'll have an issue with what they are trying to push through.
Well, let me follow up on this with Aaron, because, you know, the perception from Scott's point of view, not to put words in his mouth, but from him and his colleagues on the right, is that they feel they're on the cusp of making major gains in 2022. And I mean, whether or not that's, you know, overly optimistic, you know, besides the point, because they still believe that the Republicans have a shot at taking back the House in 2022. Now, the AOC crowd, Aaron, is saying, well, we've got to go big and we've got to go bold and we've got to go progressive in order to keep and make more gains. But you're saying Speaker Pelosi is going to say not so fast or what?
Yeah, look at the reality on the ground. I mean, Mitch McConnell most likely will still be the majority leader. And even if there is a 50-50 Senate, you know, it's going to be hard to get some of those big ticket items through. Now, the one thing that I think is we're a little bit early. We haven't even sworn in the new Congress yet.
This is what we do in D.C., right? They brought out the holidays. They brought out the holiday decor. Everyone's winding down.
Yeah, no, but here's the point. But here's the point, though. You know, I have a hard time believing that there will be big gains made by House Republicans. Maybe we keep the margins as they are. But the other thing that I would point out is, if Democrats have a shot at winning the majority in the Senate, that might happen in 2022 because there are some vulnerable Republicans and there are some open Republican seats that Democrats can very well win.
Go ahead, Scott.
I don't know that the calculus will change all of that much after the next Congress.
Go ahead, Scott.
If I may, I think one of the happiest members of Congress this week is Congressman Tom Emmer got reelected NRCC chair, defied odds, and you know is going to add a few seats, prime position to take over the House in 2022. You know, Kevin McCarthy got reelected as well. Pretty much the entire leadership team. I think they understand what the next 2 years looks like, and it's a little bit inside baseball. But in another life,
this
I used
is
to
what
work
we
Congress.
Do. I love inside baseball. Go ahead.
I used to work for Congress, and I used to carry that firewood into those fireplaces that used to smell there, Kevin.
Really?
So
okay, wait. Rip the script. Yeah. Where's Tom Keene? Where's Tom Keene when I need him? Let's rip the script. Wait, go ahead. Tell me what that's like. We have a minute left. Tell me the backstory on the wood and the fire logs in the halls of Congress and the fireplace. Go.
Well, again, if you work for a member and you're an intern, you do a bunch of things. I've had to go pick up lunches. I've had to alphabetize soda, and I've had to go down to the basement of the Capitol and pick up wood and bring it up to a congressman's hideaway to make sure that there's meetings. It's all nice and warm. Not every room has one, but you got to do it, and it's a rite of passage. And you know, you get to know. That's what you do when you coming up on the hill.
Okay. Did you ever set off a fire alarm?
No comment.
People do this? I love this. See that? This is fascinating. This is why I love my job. You find out that the interns have to get the wood to put them in the fireplaces. Who would have thought? I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg TV and Radio. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. You know, we talk so much about the coronavirus and what's happening in America. It's important to note also what's happening around the world with the virus, because in Europe, a protest over Germany's strategy to quell the virus turned violent. In Poland, They reported a record of 603 deaths of the coronavirus, and UK doctors are now warning that tough new measures must be in place when England's lockdown ends. Meanwhile, Tokyo is reporting a record number of new cases earlier today, surpassing a previous daily high set in August. So countries all over the world are grappling with this, but let's take it to the heartland of the United States. The Indy Star headline in their health section today, quote, "If Indiana were a country, our COVID-19 mortality rate would be 35th worst in the world." Congressman Trey Hollingsworth is a Republican from Indiana's 9th district, and he rejoins the program. Congressman, we're grateful for your time. I know you're concerned about what's happening in Indiana. What should policymakers and your colleagues in Congress be doing to help states like Indiana, as well as other states around the country that are dealing with this?
Well, certainly, first and foremost, we need to make sure that we are battling this biological problem with all of the tools available to us, making sure we have the staffing needs so that we can take care of those Hoosiers that are getting sick, making sure we have the latest therapies, many of which have been developed by Eli Lilly, headquartered right in the Hoosier state. And then
That's
third,
right.
making sure we're rapidly producing as many of these vaccines as possible so that we can get them to susceptible populations. First, this is a biological problem, and we must address that with as many biological strategies as possible.
And so as we hear from the Biden transition team and the politics over briefings with regards to vaccinations, should this be an apolitical issue where it's all hands on deck in order to make sure that the supply chains are ready, that once Eli Lilly has additional therapeutics and whatnot, or Pfizer or Moderna, that it's ready to be deployed immediately?
That is absolutely correct. Look, the reality is it is a remarkable scientific breakthrough to get to a vaccine that is 95% effective in just 9 months. But it will be a remarkable logistical breakthrough to get enough Americans inoculated as quickly as we want them inoculated in order to stop the spread of this next year. And so we must have all hands on deck. It must be every person, not just one party or the other party, advancing this cause and making sure that we can get the treatments that are needed to all of the places they are needed as rapidly as possible.
And just to follow up on that, the U.S. is giving the green light for the first COVID-19 diagnostic kit for self-testing at home. This was a new development today, adding to a tool that to battle the pandemic as nationwide testing capabilities come under more strain. Congressman, we've talked about this before. I think for a lot of people in their cars on their way home from work right now, they're thinking, if the NBA can figure this out to some extent, if the NFL can figure this out to some extent, why can't our states? Why can't our schools?
Right. I mean, it's a great question. And look, the reality is we need to be figuring this out. We have so many tools at our disposal that we didn't 6 months ago, so many opportunities to reduce the severity of this and also become aware if someone does become sick even more quickly than ever before. We should be focused on figuring this out instead of looking at two corner solutions on totally shut everything down for six more weeks as has been proposed or leave everything absolutely open and as is. We need to be finding ways to work together with the best of our biological sciences as well as the best of our sociological sciences to make sure that we get to the best possible outcome for Americans. I know Americans are not only concerned about COVID-19, but they're also concerned about their own incomes, about their small businesses, about their kids being educated, about going to church. And we've got to find a way to get them an answer that isn't just all or nothing, isn't zero or everything, but gets them as much of their lives as possible, as much of their livelihoods as possible, while also reducing the possibility that their loved ones, their most susceptible loved ones, may become ill.
Okay, let's talk about, let's get wonky for a second, because you brought up the economy. Targeted fiscal stimulus before the end of the year? No, yes, where are we?
I think it's low likelihood. I don't think Nancy Pelosi's position has improved negotiating power-wise, given that her majority was cut in half in the most recent election. And so I think we're going to see a targeted bill, but I'm not sure that it's going to happen by the end of the year. We certainly have seen up until this recent rise in infections that the economy has recovered fairly robustly. And aside from industries that have been in deep distress for months now, the rest of the economy is beginning to add more and more employees, and we're seeing more and more expansion. We're even seeing some hiring shortages in certain key industries. So I think we do need that targeted fiscal stimulus. I think it needs to be focused on those areas that are seeing deep distress and have seen deep distress, but I don't think we're going to see that by the end of the year. I am hopeful that early next year we will begin to see that timing as we roll out the vaccine, which I hope will further ignite the economy.
So on that particular issue, especially, you mentioned sort of the concern that Main Street has. You look at some of the more the regs, and I want to take it to a regulation that you've really been involved in, and you've really been the wonk, for lack of a better word, and that's Regulation
right.
A. Explain to us how that's going to impact, because this is super wonky, so, and I know we're coming in really minor here, but explain to us where that stands and how that could help free up some of the liquidity to some extent for the small businesses.
Look, it's a great question, and it comes down to real analysis that we just talked about. I have been skeptical that we are going to get a very large stimulus package, the likes of which we saw in March, April, and May, done again. So I've been really focused on peeling out key pieces of regulatory framework that we can get done, actually get through the House, actually get through the Senate, signed by the president, to ensure that we can make a meaningful impact on pieces of the economy. And hopefully, as we add more and more of those, that growth will begin to take off even more robustly than we've already seen. And what Reg A Plus really does, in my revision, is enables companies that have recently gone public to be able to do those follow-on offerings at a higher level than they otherwise would have been able to, so that they can get that extra growth capital, so they can hire, buy more machines, expand their locations, open more offices, do all of the things that create and engender economic growth. This, as you said, is not something that is going to drive the economy from 2.5% growth to 3.5% growth. But this, in conjunction with many of efforts I've undertaken, others in the House, others in the Senate have undertaken, I hope it will add weight to this economic recovery so that more and more Americans feel like they can participate in it and more of our businesses resume growth versus shrinking.
Chairman Clayton, SEC Chairman Jay Clayton, announcing that he's going to step down. I mean, are you nervous about a Biden administration putting someone in there that would be, you know, obviously on from a different ideological bent? He was pretty moderate.
Well, agreed. And first and foremost, Clayton did an amazing job, and I think he should get tremendous approbation for the work that he invested, the diligence, and frankly, his skill and acumen in this space. I'm hopeful that the Biden administration recognizes across a wide variety of fronts that what Americans want to see is a resumption of the economy that they had in January and February, an economy where there's very low unemployment, an economy where asset valuations are increasing, an economy where they are seeing meaningful wage increases, and the way to do that is to further enable and empower liquidity in our capital markets. I want to make sure that we have somebody at the SEC that understands mm-hmm. that the regulatory framework needs to be reshaped, needs to be tweaked to reflect America having the deepest, most liquid capital markets in the world.
Congressman Trey Hollingsworth with us. We got a minute left, so rapid fire, because I know that you, Kevin McCarthy, reelected minority leader from the caucus, as well as Steve Scalise, also reelected the minority whip. You guys feel like you're on the cusp of taking back the House in 2022. Why?
Absolutely. We cut the majority half in a year that they believed that they were going to create a tidal wave. I believe that we will take it back in 2022. There will be a Biden administration. They will overstep what those that elected them wanted them to do, and we will capitalize on that on 2022, take back the House, hold on to the Senate this year, and then move forward.
Thanksgiving, you have 30 seconds. Thanksgiving, are you doing it? And if so, what is it pie? What's the Hollingsworth family thing that you guys do for Turkey Day?
Well, we are going to do it. We are going to do it in a small number with just a few family and friends to make sure that we do our part to reduce the transmission mechanism. But I can assure you,
even though there may only be
five or six – yeah, there may only be five or six people. We'll probably have enough food for 20 or 25.
Well, what's
Kevin,
the thing?
You are always welcome in Jeffersonville.
Well, what am I going to eat? Is it pumpkin pie?
Pumpkin pie.
All right, good. All right, some Hollingsworth pumpkin pie. Much more coming up next. I'm Kevin Cirilli. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. If you were listening at the top of the show, Calvin Schnorr, Senior Economist from NAREIT, he emailed me after the segment, or emailed our team rather, Matt Shirley, and sent us his grandmother's pie recipe for apple pie. So it has some nutmeg in it, but you know, maybe that's the secret ingredient to making a good quality apple pie. I'm a pie guy. I love Thanksgiving pies. You know, our team, Reggie on the boards, he said he's definitely a blueberry pie fan. And Matt Shirley said that he's a vegan. It has to be, gluten-free or vegan. I don't even know how to do that. But he likes those pies. Aaron McPike, liberal political and media strategist. Scott Tranter, CEO of Optimus and former data science director for Marco Rubio for president. Aaron, your favorite Thanksgiving pie?
Pumpkin, pretty much always.
Okay.
I do like chocolate bourbon pecan pie.
Wow.
But I like
that's
cake
a lot of,
pie, so I'm not
it's a lot
you.
Of goodness right there. Scott, you?
Yeah, I got to agree with Aaron. A good pecan pie with a strong
it's
taste
pecan.
Of bourbon is always good.
I don't know what pecan is.
Pecan,
I know
what
pecan. You know, at Linville Orchards back in Delco. Delco has an orchard. Linville, we call it. That is literally the best pie place in America, personally. Okay, time now for my favorite part of the program, which is what is on the panel's radar. Aaron McPike, what's on your radar?
Honestly, like pretty much everyone
no,
else.
Dishonestly.
Like everyone else in anxiety-ridden Washington, D.C., seeing who the president-elect is going to appoint to the cabinet. And I think it's going to take a little bit longer than he had initially outlined because there is still no ascertainment yet because the Trump administration has not
realized or has not acknowledged that Joe Biden is, in fact, the president-elect. But once that happens, I hope to see some cabinet appointments quickly, and I can't wait to see who they are.
Okay, who do you think, let's play the parlor game, who do you think for Treasury?
Well, it seems like Lael Brainard has the inside track, don't
Block.
You?
Well, based upon my reporting, I have to, you know, I am on the radio, Kev, focus. Aaron McPike putting me on the spot. The tables have turned. Based upon my reporting, I feel that my sources are telling me, yes, Lael Brainard is without question a front runner with regards to Treasury. She is definitely named in the circles across town that typically deal with the Treasury Department. And there are some others as well. You know, I think it was just the other day, former Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen has been named. And so, you know, it'll be interesting. What about Secretary of State, Aaron?
Well, it seems to me that Senator Coons has as good a shot as any of the other names that we've been hearing.
Yeah.
But it seems that it's pretty much whether or not Tony Blinken
wants
that job. Whether or not he gets that job or he runs the NSC as the advisor. So I think it's all eyes are on what happens with Tony Blinken first.
Well, and it's interesting because here in the Beltway, especially amongst the worlds that we inhabit in terms of who we talk to and whatnot, my sources are always like, well, Kev, you know, the thing about being Secretary of State is you live out of a suitcase. And I'm like, well, after a year of sitting on the sidelines, who wouldn't want to get on a plane? But versus other departments where, you know, they're in the Oval or whatnot and really, you know, having much more face time, so to speak, with the commander in chief. So it's really interesting in terms of the personalities. It's not just the title. It's actually doing the day-to-day work and how that changes someone's life. And so, Aaron, that's very smart analysis and really an interesting take, especially because you're right. I mean, it really does give you a window, even if it's virtual, into the talk of the town, you know. And that's what everybody's talking about behind the scenes and, you know, I guess on virtual Zooms, so to speak. Okay, Scott, what's on your radar?
We touched on it a little earlier. I think, look, this upcoming CR, which could potentially very likely be, you know, President
Trump's
last... You
are all about the CR.
I am. As a former House guy, you always got the CR is always the most fun, I guess, quote-unquote fun.
Wow.
But it's President Trump's Scott potential
Tranter.
Last... yeah,
make it
President
a party.
Trump's potential last
Pull out
deal.
A CR.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's his last. It's his last potential deal. It's his last opportunity where he can make himself the spotlight. There's a lot of, you know, needs out there, not only funding the government, but, you know, around stimulus and things like that. We have a lame duck Congress. A lot of Congresspeople walking the halls who may or may not, you know, they're going to vote, but their vote may not matter in a month. And so I think we're going to see some interesting things in and around that. And it, like I said, it's the president's last potential big deal as president, and he might go out with some more news.
You know, well, it is remarkable in terms of what the president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, said earlier today, because he said that he cannot guarantee that the U.S. government will avert a December shutdown. That right there, to your point, Scott Tranter,
yeah,
would indicate that Mark Meadows is saying there might be some fireworks over this, and there
yeah.
could be a partial government shutdown around the holidays. Why would they do that for leverage?
I don't know if it's they. It's the president has to sign it. Both McConnell and Pelosi may come to a deal, but at the end of the day, it's President Trump who has to sign the deal. And he has shown, as they've done these, you know, deals over the last 4 years, he changes his mind last minute. He puts in things he wants last minute, takes things away. I mean, look, we haven't seen a whole lot of him in the last couple of weeks, so we're not really sure where he stands on these types of things. But this is his last point where he is the, you know, he's the final say. He gets to sign it. What he decides or what he wants is going to be important, and he can hold the whole deal up if he wants.
And it's remarkable because Meadows was up on Capitol Hill earlier today, of course, meeting with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and then made those comments that he can't guarantee that there will not be
yeah.
a government shutdown. That's very forward thinking, Scott, in terms of what's on your radar. What's on my radar is the Big Apple. I mean, it's in New York City, because You've got, and I'm in my Bloomberg terminal right now, New York City reeling on a 1-2 punch from school shutdowns and the subway outlook. So New York's recovery from the coronavirus outbreak suffered twin blows earlier today with the announcement of citywide school closings and the warning of massive cuts to public transit service. Parents of hundreds of thousands of students must find alternative childcare arrangements or adjust their work schedules by Thursday, tomorrow, after Mayor Bill de Blasio said the city had reached 3% positivity rate that triggered temporary halt to in-class instructions. I think that is, everyone can agree, one of the most, just the issue of education this year and what families are having to deal with is truly, truly just harrowing, to say the least. And meanwhile, workers also are facing the prospect of longer commutes because New York's Metropolitan Transportation Authority, MTA, said that they're going to have to slash subways and buses by 40% and chop commuter rail service by half if they don't get fiscal stimulus from Washington just before the holidays. Speaking of transportation, pandemic Thanksgiving means half as much driving this year. Jeffrey Baer on the Bloomberg Terminal. Vaccines are on the horizon, but won't be available soon enough to make the holidays normal again. With virus cases surging, hospitals filling up, and more U.S. states imposing restrictions, Americans are likely to drive a lot less this Thanksgiving. Only 35% will travel by car this year. That's down from 65% last year. This according to retail fuel tracker Gas Buddy. Remarkable. No one's hitting the roads. It's remarkable, a sign of the times. Aaron McPike, Scott Tranter, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to listen to me. I appreciate it. I'll be back tomorrow. Lots to get through. I'm Kevin Cirilli. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.